Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And folks, it is now or never. I've been trying to plug away on how important it is, especially with these Virginia ratification debates. How we're really starting to make the case of how the Constitution was defined, the terms and definitions of the Constitution, and so forth. And this stuff is just, this is gold. This is our greatest treasure, these constitutional ratification debates. So we've got Paul, and I know Paul's chomping at the bit because he was in the process of reading something. We had to cut him off. And so I could tell by your pace that, you know, you were one reading to, you know, maintain coherency as well as understanding what you were reading. And as we had to cut you off, I think it's really best that we, you know, pick up at the beginning of the paragraph again. And sure. Why is this so important, folks? Because we need to understand common law. And this is one of the times where somebody actually in the ratification debates lifts the hood of this mysterious thing called common law and actually talks about the appellate process. Because the process of appeals does exist in common law and how the Constitution has some very specific protections in common law. And so I think it's just worthy of going through this because I honestly believe that there are many people that talk about common law under the monarchy, which is different in how they apply the appeals and very specifically in regards to the appeal process under our Constitution. Remember, well, I said, forgive me for cutting you off, but yeah, just to finish this off, remember I did say that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, that, you know, the concept of common law protecting us from the Constitution cannot be, because right, the intent of common law was to protect us from the ruler, the king. But in our republic, our Constitution is truly our king, but common law is still a mechanism of protecting us from government, not the Constitution.
Right. So, Jerry, there's a lot of meat in this. And so when I was reading it, you know, yesterday, I was trying to get the meaning and just I was trying to get the understanding out of it, because these people don't talk like Americans talk today. All right. Their use of the language is in my view, amazing. But also it can be tedious for someone who's not looking for it or is not used to reading it.
Right.
And so I just wanted to do that. So I'm going to start. So I think where I left off was appeals from the common law, right?
Yeah, so we're going to start you off there. But actually, let me add something here. And there's a reason why we already read this before. And I believe it was Mr. Pendleton that talked about the jurisdiction. This has been said several times, but the important thing is that the federal government's ability to try a case or to define the punishment and the law of a crime is limited to, and people kind of skip over piracy, not just piracy, but what is that? Counterfeiting. So they do have jurisdiction over counterfeiting too. Treason, counterfeiting, and then laws or violations of laws of high crimes, misdemeanors, and laws over the high seas and against the laws of nations. And so because the laws of nations was actually a book of laws, it sounds like it's just this generic thing. And it probably, you know, was a very generic thing because it was what all the nations kind of agreed upon, that they wouldn't, you know, allow other nations to do in their land or what have you. So anyway, the whole point is that we're talking about the case, and most people are probably thinking in the back of their mind how the federal government had tried these cases of the January 6th, you know, supposedly insurrection, and how they basically started identifying all of these little things as crimes when they couldn't. They can't actually, the crimes that they were claiming, because an insurrection is actually, you know, an armed, you know, uprising. The Whiskey Rebellion was considered an armed uprising, and those people were tried for treason and were convicted. In the January 6th, there was no armed uprising. And as a matter of fact, the people were in government's grill under their right, their constitutional right of petitioning government for the redress of grievances, and their rights were being denied by government. So the fact that they had to break into their own house, and do I condone that? Yes. And I say that in the principle and spirit of the law, that the federal government, if it's afraid of its citizenry, then it is an indictment that it has overreached its powers. Because bottom line, if we are a Republican form of government and a government based on the rule of law, then government can be held and must be held accountable by its people in accordance with the First Amendment of the right of the people to petition government for the redress of grievances. And that was a very civil process. And because government denied it, you know, I'm not an advocate, and Paul, we've talked and we've known each other for a long time. You know, I'm not a person that supports civil unrest and civil disobedience. But I believe right. that, you know, you can't take away the human emotion of frustration, of tyranny, when people saw their world absolutely being crumbled, when the real insurrection and tyranny was happening inside the halls of Congress that day on January 6th, where they accepted an unconstitutionally formed electoral college. And even though Trump was a culprit in convincing people that it was all about election fraud and voter fraud and not about the Constitution, because why, folks? When we actually look at the Constitution, there is standing, there is jurisdiction, and that the federal government or Congress specifically violated the Constitution. That was the one that was going to win. And in some cases, in the recesses of my brain, I honestly believe that Trump himself, you know, wanted to maintain the narrative, because we've been pretty vocal since before January 6th of starting this petition with the We the People Foundation. Everything we've been doing has been in the forefront and right. We have been spot on this, and we've been nadir over the real problem. Nadir meaning we're right above where the real problem existed, and it was the Electoral College Clause. And so as I see this, I have to think that Trump was the other hand washing itself, allowing this to kind of move forward so that they could move the sentiments of the people to be willing to allow certain things down the road to where, you know, this next conservative, like if Trump becomes the president, that now, you know, they're going to give him some latitude. Does that make sense?
It's unfortunate and disturbing. I kind of see it the same way you do. You know, the other thing, you mentioned how the all these people were frustrated about, you know, their rights not being recognized. But it's even worse because this standing army has chased people down who have been on the Capitol at that time and are denying their rights now. You know, I mean, it's what, January 6, 2001 was 2.5 years ago, and there's still people in jail and being charged for even being near the Capitol.
Yes.
It's
right.
Right.
Which okay. These things aren't crimes. And, you know, it infuriates me, folks, that you have to listen to these ignorant conservative entertainers when Charles, is it Tucker? Is it Charles Tucker? what's Tucker Carlson? Tucker Carlson. I was thinking Charles Krautheimer. All of these conservative entertainers, who's passed away, all of these conservative entertainers have basically all stated, it's like they've positioned themselves in the safe space. Well, I don't condone the trespassing. They weren't, that's their house. That's our house. And we have a right to be there. As a matter of fact, we have a guaranteed legal open door policy we've got protected, that we have the right to get in there and get in their grill and petition them. And they have to have a mechanism to receive our petitions. And when they lock us out, they have made a law where it starts, the First Amendment starts with Congress shall make no law abridging this right. And by closing and locking that door, that was a law. That was a policy. That was a rule that they enforced to keep the people out. They denied us our rights.
I don't know if you, it's been a while. I don't know if you actually saw it, but I think Tucker Carlson released some video that showed that not only were they not trespassing, but they got let into the Capitol. What the mainstream narrative has been is that they violently broke into the Capitol and that the congressmen were running for their lives. That's not true either. And so it's.
Oh, yeah. I know that they've released that. It's kind of changed some people's tones. But for a long time, none of them were taking the right position. None of them have taken once the right position. Oh, well, further evidence shows that we didn't really break in. So what? So what? They were violating the laws by locking the doors. The laws were broken when they actually locked the doors. They can't. They have no right to protect themselves from us, the people. This is a self-government. And when the people may be misguided, and unfortunately, that's our problem. We've got too many people that are telling us to do the wrong things. You know, let's go have a protest. Let's go have a rally. We have a president that got elected based on having rallies and protests, kind of, if you really think about it. I mean, that's how he started his presidency.
Well, so here's the other thing. This guy's really constitutionally illiterate, because if he knew anything about the Constitution, he would give people the tools that they need to get something done.
Right. Which is why I do my Monday show. You know, and I really try to help everybody understand what a real leader would do. What a real leader, understand the Constitution, because the Constitution gives him tools. It gives him the power, the vested power to enforce the Constitution. So he can actually enforce it, but he can't necessarily force the Supreme Court and the Congress and all of these executive departments to be scuttled. Only the states can do that. He can actually turn off, you know, them enforcing the laws, like shutting the ATF down to say, you know what, you just come on back home and you're going to collect a check and you're going to be sweeping the floors, or we're going to put you to productivity stuff, and they won't be happy. They won't be happy that they can't bust down doors and do things, but that's okay. That's okay, because we're now going to actually start enforcing the Constitution and the rule of law. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Great. Hey, let me run something by you. Eventually, we need to get to this common law thing. I talk to a lot of people about common law, and I think, you know, yesterday we had a much better understanding of what the common law is and what it relates to. But there is a misunderstanding that, you know what?
You want to get back to the reading?
What happened? It's I'm too young to have senior moments.
Oh, okay.
And I just had one.
Oh, okay.
I knew I was going to say something. Let's just get back to reading. Okay. And come back to me.
Well, okay. That's the gentle way of not acknowledging a senior moment. Let's just get back to reading. Anywho, okay. Go ahead.
We're starting with appeals from the common law. Is that where we left
correct.
Off yesterday?
That's correct.
Okay. Appeals from the common law courts involve the consideration of facts by the superior court when there is a special verdict. They consider the fact and law together and decide accordingly, but they cannot introduce new testimony. When a jury proceeds to try a case in an inferior court, a question may arise on the competency of a witness or some other testimony. The inferior court decides that question. It either admits or rejects that evidence. The party intending to object states the matter in a bill of exceptions. The jury then proceeds to try the cause according to the judgment of the inferior court, and on appeal, the superior court determines upon the judgment of the inferior court. They do not touch the testimony. If they determine that the evidence was either improperly admitted or rejected, they set aside the judgment and send back the cause to be tried again by a jury in the same court. These are the only cases in appeals from inferior courts of common law where the superior court can even consider facts incidentally. I feel the danger, as much as any gentleman in this committee, of carrying a party to the federal court to have a trial there. But it appears to me that it will not be the case. If that be the practice, which I have now stated, and that it is, the practice must be admitted. The appeals may be limited to a certain sum. I make no doubt it will be so. You cannot prevent appeals without great inconveniences, but Congress can prevent that dreadful oppression which would enable many men to have a trial in the federal court, which is ruinous. There is a power which may be considered as a great security, the power of making what regulations and exceptions in an appeals they may think proper may be so contrived as to render appeals as to law in fact proper and perfectly inoffensive. How will this power be exercised? If I thought there was a possibility of danger, I should be alarmed.
Okay, so one of the things, and he kind of steps into this, he says, I feel the danger as much as any gentleman in this committee of carrying a party to the federal court to have a trial there. Well, hold on here. What type of court? What type of trial would the federal court actually be able to try? Would they try somebody for larceny, for murder, for kidnapping? No.
Well, they shouldn't be.
They have no jurisdiction over those things. So for a person to actually be driven into the, a federal court system as the initiator of a law, like what we're seeing with the January 6th, the federal court had no jurisdiction over this. They had none. As a matter of fact, what should have been said is, that these people's rights were being denied and they were only exercising their rights. And this is where the courts, and this is where everybody should be taking their direct appeals. I mean, all of these people that did plea bargains and bought into these plea bargains should actually have a case for appeal because their rights were actually denied by the fact that they were even tried for a crime that they actually never committed. The crime was committed by Congress.
Right.
Does that make sense? This should be a class action lawsuit to the federal courts that, the whole trial was just a bunch of smoke and mirrors. Anyway.
Here's another question I have for you really quick. Now, we can take cases to state courts. Why do people take a case to a federal court? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. So I'll give you a good example because the cross on a hill, and people will take that case into a state court, and the state court will rule that, that's private property. That's okay. And then they try to take it to a federal court because the federal court has no limitations anymore. They've actually expanded their jurisdiction, or actually, I think that they've have this unwritten policy that there is nothing that they would not consider under their jurisdiction. In other words, they have no rules of jurisdiction anymore. They will assume everything unless it is not politically expedient. Then they will shut their doors to it. And so that's how we see the courts. The federal courts are that way now. And so they use these things. And a good case in point is Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims, when there were two cases where people talked about their representation, and their vote, wasn't equal, because they lived in a a more populated area, and they wanted more power in their representation by taking representation from other counties. And so right. Reynolds v. Sims basically backhanded the states, or these two cases, backhanded the states and said, how dare you have a Republican form of government? You will have a democracy form of government, and you will ensure that every person has an equal representation and equal power of their representation. Well, that's not so that's not the federal court. They had no jurisdiction over that. Anyway.
So let me see if I understood this. This came up in a state court, and then it
yes.
And then they didn't get the answer they wanted. So they initiated a course in federal court.
Yes.
This wasn't an appeal. This was an initiated court in federal court where they're really
I don't know whether it was an appeal or not. I'm going to say that based on the voting principle, if they initiated in the federal court, they violated jurisdiction. Because the principle right. of the case was, you know, it was the right of, you know, representation or what have you. And there's nowhere in the Constitution where the federal court has any, you know, any jurisdiction over a voter's, you know, equality in representation. The only four amendments regarding voting where there's any mention of federal protection of voting is to ensure that nobody can be denied of voting for their race. Nobody can be denied of voting by their gender. Nobody can be denied of voting by a poll tax or by age, as long as you were 18 or older. So those are the only things that the federal court would have jurisdiction regarding voters. And when somebody, you know, concocted this concept to open the door for a democracy, if they actually walked into a federal court, because I haven't done, you know, I'm still working on that, and I'm working on some petitions first, but I will get into this and dive into whether it was initiated by a federal court where they actually, you know, just again obliterated the jurisdiction factor and just used this as an agenda, because that's what the federal courts have been doing. They've been using agendas to attack the Constitution and to move our government towards a socialist democracy where they already, you know, it's already been, you know, basically pushed into this monarchical party form of government and moving us into the socialist or the democracy or the democratic socialist form of government that we have today. So anyway, let me just go down to the next one, because this is where Mr. Mason now is going to pipe in. Now, you only have a minute, 2 minutes to read this. And as we look at this, this is kind of a lengthy assertion that Mr. Mason is going to be making regarding common law. So, folks, these highlights that we're giving you on common law will help you understand why common law was really elevated in importance, you know, regarding Mason, Henry, and so forth by the Anti-Federalists, and how, you know, it was basically lulled, or I should say, you know, how Pendleton and how, you know, all of these men that were addressing common law were really putting it back into context. So anyway.
So real quick, so I'm looking at Mr. Mason.
Uh-huh.
Oh, there it is. I found it. Okay, I just didn't go down far enough. Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you got less than a minute. So if you...
Okay.
You know what? One of the things that, you know, I just want to emphasize, and I say this, I've said it a few times this week, and we can, you know, kind of, you know, use this to fill the gap between now and the break. When we look at common law, again, was the power provided to the people to protect themselves from a tyrant that was a monarch. The Constitution itself created very specific and delegated powers. In other words, it changed the makeup of common law in America, because its function was no longer to protect it from the Constitution. Its protection was from it and government. Because the Constitution being the supreme law, obviously there could not be this, what I'll say, and we're going into break now, Paul, so I'll pick you up on the other side of the break. This whole point is that the common law was to ensure that government stayed within the rule of law, stayed within those delegated powers and only those powers. And that was the beautiful thing about this Constitution and it being the supreme law in a nation of common law.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so here's Mason, who's kind of, you know, the guardian of common law and the guardian of the people. And, you know, the guy that was really focused on very few aspects. Again, didn't say much about the slavery stuff because, you know, he was absolutely against slavery. And so go ahead and let's see, you know, what he's contributing here.
So we're starting with with what says a discrimination arises, correct?
Yep.
Okay. A discrimination arises between common law trials and trials in courts of equity and admiralty. In these two last, depositions are committed to record, and therefore on an appeal, the whole fact goes up. The equity of the whole case, comprehending fact and law, is considered and no new evidence requisite. Is it so in courts of common law? Their evidence is only given viva voce. I don't know what that means. I know not a single case where there is an appeal of fact as to common law. I may be mistaken. Where there is an appeal from an inferior to a superior court with respect to matters of fact, a new witness may be introduced who is perhaps suborned by the other party 1,000 miles from the place where the first trial was had. These are some of the inconveniences and insurmountable objections against this general power being given to the federal courts. Gentlemen will perhaps say there will be no occasion to carry up the evidence by viva voce testimony. You know, if you know what that is, GR, I'd like to, because that's a Latin term.
It's by word of mouth. Oh, in other words, okay. Evidence is by word of mouth. Okay.
All right. Because Congress may order it to be committed to writing and transmitted in that manner with the rest of the record. It is true, they may say, but it is as true that they may not. But suppose they do, little conversant as I am in this subject, I know there is a great difference between viva voce evidence given at the bar and testimony given in writing. I leave it to gentlemen more conversant in these matters to discuss it. They are also to have cognizance in controversies to which the United States shall be a party. This power is superadded that there might be no doubt, and that all cases arising under the government might be brought before the federal court. Gentlemen will not, I presume, deny that all revenue and excise controversies and all proceedings relative to the duties of the officers of government, from the highest to the lowest, may and must be brought by these means to the federal courts, in the first instance to the inferior federal court, and afterwards to the superior court. Every fact proved with respect to these in the court below may be revived in the superior court, but this appellate jurisdiction is to be under regulations of Congress. What these regulations may be, God only knows. their jurisdiction further extends to controversies between citizens of different states. Can we not trust our state courts with the decision of these? If I have a controversy with a man in Maryland, if a man in Maryland has my bond for £100, are not the state courts competent to try it? Is it suspected that they would enforce the payment if unjust or refuse to enforce it if just? The very idea is ridiculous. What? Carry me 1,000 miles from home, from my family and business, to where perhaps it will be impossible for me to prove that I paid it? Perhaps I have a respectable witness who saw me pay the money, but I must carry them 1,000 miles to prove it or be compelled to pay it again. Is there any necessity for this power? It ought to have no unnecessary or dangerous power. Why should the federal courts have this cognizance? Is it because one lives on one side of the Potomac and the other on the other? Suppose I have your bond for £1,000. If I have any wish to harass you, or if I be of a litigious disposition, I have only to assign it to a gentleman in Maryland. This assignment will involve you in trouble and expense. What effect will this power have between British creditors and the citizens of this state? This is a ground on which I shall speak with confidence. Everyone who heard me speak on the subject knows that I always spoke for the payment of the British debts. I wish every honest debt to be paid. Though I would wish to pay the British creditor, yet I would not put it in his power to gratify private malice to our injury. Let me be put right if I be mistaken, but there is not, in my opinion, a single British creditor that can bring his debtors to the federal court. Translation, please, GR.
The 11th Amendment.
Okay.
He was actually pointing out the real problem. And so when, you know, Mason basically identified a true problem, a defect in the Constitution, where one person could easily go to another state or use another state, creating a interstate jurisdiction issue, which the federal court would have. The 11th Amendment did away with that.
Okay.
But he's just kind of pointing out that, you know, in common law, these, you know, how it functions. And literally right here, he laid out the case for the 11th Amendment. And the 11th Amendment was, you know, recommended and passed when?
I'm looking at it. February 7th, 1795.
There you go, folks. I mean, so they were just kicking the tires, and all of a sudden these things started popping up where people were using interstate, you know, laws to, you know, push things into the federal court. And this is when the state said, nope, you cannot construe these cases under your jurisdiction anymore.
Okay. So if I have this,
but I'm going to tell you right now, folks, the 11th Amendment has been ignored. It was enforced, and then after the Organic Act, and as the growth of the federal government became insatiable, well, then the federal court started ignoring it. They claim to use the 14th Amendment, or you'll hear the haters of the 14th Amendment make that assertion, but you will not find anywhere in the debates in Congress nor in the 14th Amendment whatsoever any argument that supports, you know, or any evidence that supports that claim. So go ahead.
Okay. So what this did, the 11th Amendment, what the 11th Amendment did is actually, it sounds like it's really simple. I'm in Missouri. Someone else is in Maryland, and they take, instead of suing me in my court here in Missouri, they take it to the federal court. That sounds right. And this is what prohibited that.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. There's another part to it. And that is real quick. Judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States citizens of another state or the citizens or subject of any foreign state. So how would this manifest itself? You know, someone from Mexico would sue me, and it would go to federal court. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right. So, words, you know, so if you kind of look at everything that you just read that Mason stated, that, you know, mm-hmm. how they could, you know, drag you across the country and force right. the evidence to be brought into a federal court. And and so the point was that the 11th Amendment basically squelched that and said, look, you know, in cases between individuals, you know, and a from one state to another, even if it was, I think, foreign, then, you know, the state court has the sole jurisdiction to where, you know. And so, in other words, this would not be had by the people of necessarily. Well, okay, so if the claim be made in Virginia, you know, somebody's been done harm because they've, you know, stolen something and they're in another state, that person should be extradited to Virginia to be tried.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that's where the crime was. That's where the crime was committed, right?
Right.
And so, you know, in other words, Mason was literally laying out, and just like previously, Mason laid out the formula of how to basically marginalize the militia so that the federal government would be tempted to abandon it unconstitutionally. Now, nobody ever included, oh, well, you know, this all is based on violations of the Constitution. They just said, you know, all they've got to do is marginalize and not train, not equip, and not do the things that they're supposed to do, so that when they all of a sudden need one, they say, well, you know, we don't have a militia, so we'll have to create a standing army.
And so what you're saying is Mason was supportive of the militia, but he was warning, he was foreseeing how it could be marginalized.
And in this particular case, he was seeing how this could easily be subverted by giving cases in between a, you know, people of two different states or a nation and a state where that would subvert, you know, the essence of justice.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. That makes sense.
All right. So now Madison, you know, gets up and starts talking and runs out of time. So he comes back the next day. And, you know, he makes the, because literally he just basically gets a paragraph out. And then the next day, Friday, June 20th, he comes back and he starts, you know, talking again. And so we start off with this first note and then we get into some jurisdiction.
Okay. The second question which I proposed to consider was whether such organization be made as would be safe and convenient for the states and the people at large. Let us suppose that the subjects of its jurisdiction are only enumerated and power given to the general legislature to establish such courts as might be judged necessary and expedient. Do not think that, in that case, any rational objection could be made to it, any more than would be made to the general power of legislation in certain enumerated cases. If that would be safe, this appears to me better and more restrictive so far as it may be abused by extension of power. The most material part is the discrimination of superior and inferior jurisdiction and the arrangement of its powers as where it shall have original and where appellate cognizance. Where it speaks of appellate jurisdiction, it expressly provides that such regulations will be made as will accommodate every citizen so far as practicable in any government. The principle, hang on a minute, I lost my place. Okay, sorry about that. The principal criticism which has been made was against the appellate cognizance as well as fact as law. I'm happy that the honorable member who presides and who is familiarly acquainted with the subject does not think it involves anything unnecessarily dangerous. I think that the distinction of fact as well as law may be satisfied by the discrimination of the civil and common law. But if gentlemen should contend that appeals as to fact can be extended to jury cases, I contend that by the word regulations, it is in the power of Congress to prevent it or prescribe such a mode as will secure the privilege of jury trial. They may make a regulation to prevent such appeals entirely, or they may remand the fact or send it to an inferior contiguous court to be tried or otherwise preserve that ancient and important trial.
So what he's saying here is he's injecting what I have been saying this whole time, that the only way a case, because what Mason was using, you know, as a case of property, somebody stole your property and ran to another state. Well, in all cases between, technically the 12th Amendment would, you know, have the jurisdiction of that. And which is why, not the 12th Amendment. Without the 11th Amendment, the federal government would have any cases between a citizen of one state and another state, because that's what they granted there. But as Madison's pointing out, because Pendleton was making comment that, you know, dragging things up into the federal court, you know, he wasn't differentiating jurisdiction. In other words, there was this concept that, you know, anything and everything could be dragged into a federal court, and they couldn't. They could only do those things. And so he's kind of saying, as I said, only those things arising under this Constitution is their jurisdiction for the federal court. So in many cases, when it comes to election laws of the states and so forth, it is not for the federal courts to do. They have no standing regarding how a state executes its election. The only specific things regarding elections that the federal government has jurisdiction is the Electoral College and the choosing of the president. That is clearly delineated and how it must be done. Now, the enforcements and all of those things, as far as voters' rights, you know, or as far as a person having the ability to vote and that right to vote, that's something that's under the federal jurisdiction, because those four amendments granted in the cases of race, gender, taxation or access by, you know, creating fees and taxes, or age are issues that the federal court has jurisdiction over. And citizenship, as a matter of fact, they're supposed to have jurisdiction and enforcing that only U.S. citizens, because in every single one of those amendments, it clearly stipulates that only a U.S. citizen. And why is it that the federal government is not coming down and saying, hey, you have to, you know, eradicate and remove every foreigner, because they have no right to vote, because the Constitution is clear on that. In all four of the amendments, it was stipulated. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how the court has become so subversive. And, you know, we see today in where they claim that, you know, properly so, no standing. I tell people that the federal court, when it comes to voter fraud and those types of things, that they really don't have standing. And then they contradict themselves when they jump into things that they have no standing on. So It's how they perceive the, you know, the way to win, because they will do whatever it takes. The ends justify the means. They'll do whatever it takes to continue getting the ball down the field, because it's all about scoring. It's all about winning. And they have they have a place, you know, very clear that they want to go. So he continues on. Madison now continues on regarding jurisdiction. So go ahead and continue here.
Okay. I have observed that generalists suppose that the general legislature will do everything mischievous they possibly can, and that they will omit to do everything good which they are authorized to do. If this were a reasonable supposition, their objections would be good. I consider it reasonable to conclude that they will as readily do their duty as deviate from it, nor do I go on the grounds mentioned by gentlemen on the other side, that we are to place unlimited confidence in them and expect nothing but the most exalted integrity and sublime virtue. But I go on this great Republican principle, that the people will have virtue and intelligence to select men of virtue and wisdom. Is there no virtue among us? If there be not, we are in a wretched situation. No theoretical checks, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea. If there be sufficient virtue and intelligence in the community, it will be the exercise in the selection of these men, so that we do not depend on their virtue or put confidence in our rulers, but in people who are to choose them. I just need to pause here for a minute.
Sure.
That this is the very thing that I think the people need to understand, that the power is in the people. And here's the other thing. You kind of get what you deserve. In other words, if we're ignorant, we're going to get what we deserve.
Yeah.
But if we are choosing men that we believe to be wise and virtuous, that's the type of government we'll get.
Right.
And one of the cool things about this, about the Sounders' vision, is that this state may have, may be bad, okay, like California,
uh-huh.
okay, but this other state may be a bastion of liberty. And what are people going to do? They're going to vote with their feet in their U-Haul trucks and move to where they have the most liberty. So I really, this particular paragraph kind of stands out for that.
So one thing that he's talking about, you know, because he's not mentioning the other thing. So I build upon everything he says here. In many of my shows and so forth, it's all built upon all of this. However, the one thing, because at this point in time, the Bill of Rights and the right of petition for the redress of grievances is not in the Constitution, because it's not no longer just based on virtue, that we basically hinge the entire term of a candidate based on virtue. Even though they're under oath, we know that they will, you know, try to create, you know, a way to, you know, to ignore doing what they should do. And so until the right of petition was granted in the Bill of Rights to this Constitution, now we had a mechanism of holding them accountable. No longer we were just dependent on their virtues. We could hold them accountable. But the next problem that they didn't include in the Bill of Rights was the ability for us to quickly and easily remove them, because really what would happen is, if now that you petitioned them and said, okay, you know, I've done wrong, and, you know, and they, everybody looks around and goes, well, shame on you, we're going to censor you. And, you know, this is what happened with Adam Schiff. We're going to censor you. What an insult to the supreme law of the land, because we now have, with Adam Schiff, we have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. He should have been banned and removed from Congress as the supreme law of the land demands. And bottom line, they say, oh, well, you know, and every state in the union and even Congress still basically says, well, to remove them, we have to impeach them. Bull crap. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment alleviated the whole process of impeachment. And the only standing for the process of impeachment is when somebody actually violates the moral character, like they get drunk all the time, or they're beating people and they're committing crimes, you know, out in the public. Then, okay, now you impeach a person. But when they violate their oath of office, when they violate, there is no impeachment process, they're gone. It's supposed to be that clear cut, folks. And so we have, I can't say it enough, God gave us everything. He gave us that oath to legally bind them. He then gave us the ability to petition them and call them out on violating their oath. And he gave us now this, the knockout punch of saying, because we've proven this, you must be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, it's a sad day that we the people have to demand that the supreme law of the land be abided by. But that's right. What we have to do. But here he's talking about virtuous people. He's talking about this important need of virtue in the people, you know, that we elect, that these politicians be virtuous. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be. We should actually try to elect those who are virtuous. But we can't count on it. People are corruptible. The person you elected may have been the most virtuous person in the land, but they were the most susceptible to corruption, and they sell you out. So they didn't lack, they lacked on integrity, but they had great virtue. Bottom line, folks, is that what Madison is talking about here was his perspective was limited on what the Constitution had. Because bottom line, what he's saying means that we could be subject to bad government, that we needed to make sure that we were getting virtuous people. Because as the Constitution laid it out, they had enumerated powers, and if they started usurping it, what were we going to do?
Right.
And so this is why when the this is why when the when Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, and so we got about 2 minutes, so 3 minutes, so we'll get to the rest of this next week.
Okay.
So when Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, you know, Madison could have easily, had he had, because they had the Bill of Rights for petition, but they did not have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Had he had Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, he could have easily then stated the case that they violated their oath, and everybody that signed that bill, and even, except for the president, because the Section 3 does not touch the president. He has to be impeached. And so what you do is you clear out Congress, you get rid of all of them, and then you'll now have a Congress that will impeach the president. And that's how John Adams, sorry for stumbling up a little bit on the words, but John Adams, I believe, had we actually had everything that was necessary, there's no doubt in my mind, Madison and Jefferson would not have had to pull off a coup, that they would have actually been able to hold these guys accountable by proving and using the law and the people at that time that was virtuous enough to demand, and it would have happened. There's no doubt in my mind they would have cleaned out Congress by the state legislatures, and the state legislatures would then push Congress, this newly replaced Congress, to impeach John Adams for signing that. And bottom line, had they actually had everything they needed, we would have had the precedents. There's no doubt in my mind. It's a tough road to go down to hold people accountable. But folks, if you do not hold people accountable, they will take every last breath you have from you.
They're on the way.
Absolutely. And so that's why, you know, when it comes to, you know, the property, and it's one of the reasons why we actually, one of the things I'll read after we go through the ratification debates is I actually read the 1792 Madison's essay on property, where he talks about how important our property is, that when we look at what our rights are, what these privileges and immunities that are protected by the Constitution, you know, that these things are rights that are given to us by God in the Constitution, even though it can't declare that these rights are given to us by our Creator, because they don't want to establish a religion, they make these things immutable. There's nothing they can do to touch these things that we call inalienable rights. So,
GR, yes. I read that document last week. It is amazing.
Oh, the essay on paragraph? Or the paragraph?
Oh, yeah, the essay on
property.
Essay.
Yes.
Property.
Yes.
It's
yes,
an
yes.
amazing document.
Yes. And this is where he makes the connection that it is said that a man has rights in his property. It is equally stated that he has property in his rights. Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. I know you're being drowned out here, but thank you again for joining us, folks. We're making the case. I can't tell you that you're getting this or and all of this gold and gems from any other source of content on the radio, TV, or anything else. I'm GR Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities,
responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.